Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Wednesday, June 26th. I'm Stephen Overly. Assessing political risk is more art than science. You try to predict where a geopolitical fault line is about to open, and then what you can do to avoid getting swallowed up. Eurasia Group is one of the big players in this game. And when it comes to tech, they see a lot of risks.
We've never really seen anything of this magnitude, and we've certainly never seen companies that are so enmeshed in the daily details of people's lives as we do with tech.
This is Gerald Butts. He's the vice chair of Eurasia Group and a former political hand to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Gary told me that the recent rush into AI only raises the stakes because countries are now competing to own the AI future. And large U.S. tech companies already have the upper hand.
That's a massive incumbent advantage of the United States as the apex predator, so to speak, in the geopolitical food chain. So yeah, absolutely. AI has made an imbalanced technological landscape even more so.
My path crossed with Jerry's a couple of weeks ago at the U.S.-Canada summit in Toronto. But I called him up to hear more about the geopolitical risks around tech and the tensions it's creating across the U.S. northern border. Here's our conversation. Jerry, welcome to Politico Tech.
Oh, it's a thrill to be here.
You know, when you kind of look at the way things are playing out, you're all about assessing risk. What's the biggest risk that you see?
Well, that these companies become fundamentally ungovernable within any domestic country, right? That they become too large. We all became familiar with the too big to fail moniker during the great financial crisis. These companies may become too big to govern.
I thought you might say China. A lot of people say China these days.
Well, China is a big risk. And if we move from AI in our discussion of quantum computing, I think that's an even bigger black box. Whereas we, notwithstanding the recent dislocation in research cooperation between China and the United States in a lot of these fields, there's still the inertia of 20 years of researchers in both places sharing their work and knowing what each other is doing. That is not true for quantum. That it's maybe 5 years ago, the top research institutions in the United States knew what was going on in China on quantum and vice versa, but that's not the case anymore.
Got it. So that sounds like a blind spot of looking
Absolutely.
Ahead and who's in the lead, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's hard to assess. I think it's the United States is there's a lot of hand wringing within the U.S. And I can say this as a Canadian, as someone has a little bit of distance from it. There's a lot of hand wringing in the United States about tech competition with China. But the United States has done a pretty successful job of containing China's technological ambitions, especially in semiconductors, but more broadly in the systems that we depend on to run the internet. The United States is way ahead overall.
From your view from Canada, I mean, is that tech competition with China warranted? Is it overblown? You know, in some ways, I feel like China is a boogeyman on the global stage, and that's kind of brought countries together.
Yeah, I think, well, that's a really good question, and it has a really complex answer, but let me take a stab at it. And this isn't necessarily from a Canadian perspective. You sort of have to break it down into different sectors. I spend most of my life thinking about the energy transition, the decarbonization process globally, and the pace at which it's operating in different countries and regions of the world. And I remember when I worked in the Trudeau government, for those of your listeners who don't know, I was principal secretary to the prime minister from 2015 to 2019. And one of the first files we had to deal with in the 2015 election was the Paris Accord, which the negotiations for the Paris Agreement were in the final home stretch. And I can say with absolute certainty that it wouldn't have concluded as positively as it did had it not been for what was called, I think even in public at the time, G2 cooperation between Barack Obama and Xi Jinping.
Right.
And then you fast forward until, I guess, barely 8.5 years later, last month, Barack Obama's vice president, now president, is putting 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs. And that'll show you the degree to which not just the China-U.S. relationship has deteriorated in the interim, but how difficult it's become to segregate industries. And why has it become difficult? It's because the glue that holds them together is the semiconductor industry.
Interesting.
I have an EV. I don't know if you have an EV. Sometimes it, compared to an ICE car, it's like driving around a piece of software, right?
Right.
And that shows you how difficult it is to disaggregate the politics from the operational necessities of each of these sectors.
It's hard to see trend changing course, you know, given how central semiconductors are. And obviously the U.S. is really digging in, trying to rebuild its domestic semiconductor industry.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you see that tension playing out?
Well, I think you're right. I think the trajectory we're on is pretty well established now. I think in some ways, all of the low-hanging fruit of deglobalization have already been plucked, that from here on in, disaggregating the U.S.-China trade is going to be a lot more difficult than it has been. All the easy stuff has been done already through tariffs and some non-tariff trade barriers. But I do think that, you know, if there's anything that both sides of the aisle agree on in Washington, it's that the relationship with China has to change. And I had a senior official say to me at our Canada-U.S. summit last week that the only really functioning committee on Capitol Hill these days is the House Committee on China, because the Republicans and Democrats are constantly outbidding each other for ways to be tough on China. So on that issue only, they're pointed in the same direction. It's by definition very difficult to create a governance framework that applies the same laws to them wherever they are.
You know, you mentioned that you were the principal secretary to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, very close, part of his inner circle. Do you still talk to him at all these days?
We're friendly, but I made an ironclad commitment mostly to myself when I left that I would not be one of those people who goes on television or on podcasts and tells my former colleagues doing next to impossibly difficult jobs how to do those jobs, because it was one of the things that drove me craziest when I was in one of those jobs. So yeah, I don't really get involved in Canadian domestic politics anymore.
Yeah, it's easier to talk about it than it is to do it. That's
for
sure.
It's way, like most things in life, from politics to parenting, it's right. A lot easier to talk about than to do it.
And there's probably a lot of similarities there too, between politics and parenting, but that's a different podcast. I would be curious if you'll weigh in. You know, his administration has put forward this proposal of like $2.4 billion Canadian dollars, I think, for AI research and investment. What do you make of the approach they're taking?
Well, I'm not unbiased because I was involved in the first national AI strategy in the 2016-2017 period. And in some ways, it mirrors the classic Canadian problem, right? That we have, if you want to be unkind to Canada, you would say that the economic development strategy for the country, regardless of which party is in power, has been a version of sidle up to that giant river of American capital I described earlier and find a comfortable place and get out a straw, right?
Right.
And I think that's hyperbolic, but not really too much. And that comes with downside consequences. So it's always a risk when Canada is trying to develop a new industry that the United States is simultaneously interested in. We're going to lose a lot of firms and talent to the United States. Now, that's one way of looking at it. My view is a little bit different. I think that's always a danger, but we have some unique attributes in Canada. For instance, the cleanest electricity grid in the world with a lot of open space and cold weather that could host server farms. And we should be building an economic approach to that that may be provincial or maybe national, it may be regional. It doesn't really need to be a Government of Canada initiative. If I were in one of the large provinces, I would be thinking very hard about how I attract all of this economic activity that we know is going to follow from the AI revolution to Canada. So I think, like most things, living next to the United States, there's no other country in the world I'd rather share a 10,000 kilometer border than the United States. But it comes with some downsides when you live next to the most productive, dynamic, innovative economy in the history of the world.
You know, I know you said you don't follow the domestic politics and policy in Canada as much as you used to. I'm curious if you've watched any of the latest with digital services taxes, mm-hmm. which is a very niche thing that people in tech care a lot about.
Yeah.
Recently, Canada has passed a law and it's pursuing digital services tax again. What do you make of that dispute?
Well, I think in some ways, it's a really good example of the general dynamic I was trying to describe earlier, Stephen. I think that, for instance, let me give you a bit of history here. I don't think it occurred to very many people as the internet was being developed in 1995. I remember this will date me for your listeners, but I was in the first class at McGill University where everybody was given an email address, right?
Okay. So
that will tell you, I'll be 53 next month. So that will, and I think that was 1991. So in the early 90s, as the internet was being developed, people in Canada didn't immediately think, holy smokes, this is going to be a threat to our ability to regulate the cultural content in our public sphere, right?
Right.
The first thing that came to people's mind was not that, holy smokes, maybe the CBC won't be relevant anymore, you know? And so, as a consequence, now that it has become a mortal threat to Canada's ability to promote Canadian content on the quote-unquote airwaves, they're more digital these days than broadcast, of course, the governments have tried to take the infrastructure, the legislative and regulatory infrastructure that had been built for that old world and apply it to a new one, right?
Right.
And that's always going to be trying to grind a square peg into a round hole. And what you're seeing, the sort of spin-off effects of that process, is all this friction, whether it's the digital services tax, whether it was the Netflix agreements. It's basically Canadians saying, how do we maintain a Canadian cultural identity in this new world where people's entertainment and information cannot be bound within national borders? So I sound like I'm avoiding your question. I'm not. I don't think there are any good answers, but I think that this is a predictable outcome of a situation where the government of Canada is searching for tools built in the old world to govern the new one.
Is there a risk of this becoming like a new trade dispute?
Absolutely.
I was a trade reporter for a while, and so there's a anywhere that Canadians and the U.S. can hold a grudge, it's in trade.
I'm
happy to talk to anyone about dairy or lumber.
As someone who spent a lot more time than I ever would have imagined thinking about skim milk powder and having conversations with Bob Lighthizer about it, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Are these trade frictions now to think about between the U.S. and Canada with tech kind of at the center?
I think the term of art in trade circles is irritant. They could be called an add to dairy and softwood as a perennial irritant that will be an annuity for trade lawyers and negotiators to send their kids to college on both sides of the border, I'm sure. So I think it does become, and the challenge heading into a mandatory, well, not a mandatory renegotiation, but a kind of fork in the road where each of the three countries who are signatories to NAFTA, I still call it NAFTA, have to choose whether they want to renegotiate or they kick the ball into the high grass for 15 years
right.
in 2026. Any irritant that threatens to open up that whole process is something that needs to be paid attention to for sure.
You were talking about sort of Canada finding its place in like this new world and the things like the digital services tax or like the Netflix agreements, which have to do with where content is produced and what content is promoted.
Yeah.
I'm curious how AI fits into that calculus. For instance, last year, Canada passed the Online News Act that required folks like Facebook and Google to pay news publishers. And there are some people now saying that AI companies should also have to pay because they're vacuuming up all sorts of data and information. How does AI fit into sort of that issue?
Well, it's another disruptor to what had been a relatively stable equilibrium, right? And I think about the stuff in historical terms and what AI and digital technologies are doing to the communication space writ large is not much different, I think, even in scale, really, than, for instance, the invention of the telegraph or the invention of the radio or the invention of the television. Anything that fundamentally changed the way individual citizens receive their information and transmit their views about that information or can otherwise repackage it and share it with their fellow citizens, has issued in a period of political and legislative disruption, right? Mm. And historically, I find it interesting how this is almost always the case. It's a 10 to 20 year period after the invention of a landmark communication technology until things settle into a new equilibrium. We just happen to be lucky for us at the birth of commercialized AI. So I think that you can expect that it will detonate many of the regulatory frameworks that were designed to govern slower, less ubiquitous technologies.
I have to question, because of the pace of technological advancement these days, whether that equilibrium will ever kind of be felt again.
That's a good question.
Because the tech advances so fast that before you can even find your balance, you're on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, velocity is one important variable. But the other, I think, is the complexity of the change, right? So when you think about the invention of the telegraph in the 1820s, I think it was, or maybe it was the 1830s, I can't remember. Obviously, it wasn't there. We went from all of human history, where you could only send a message as far as a person could run or a horse could gallop in a day, to instantaneous transmission across large distances. That revolutionized politics, right? It revolutionized business. It revolutionized the media. And I don't think the change we're going through now is qualitatively that disruptive. I don't. Then again, that period only really settled down after the Civil War. So I'm not sure we want to go through that again, right?
Right.
But it's going to, you know, it's a very, if you're working on these issues, it's you learn very quickly to be humble about making detailed forecasts, but it's an incredibly fascinating time to be alive.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. I know you said you don't like to comment on like your former colleagues and the job in Canadian government. I'm curious about the U.S., though, especially yeah. from where you sit in Canada. Obviously, we're in an election year. You know, Eurasia Group, when it made its list of top risks for 2024, sort of put the U.S. election at number one. I'd be curious, what's your view on like what's at stake in November? And in particular, if there's kind of a role for tech in all of that, that you're watching?
Yeah, definitely. I think our house view is that Trump stands a 60% chance of being elected. And that's pretty close to a coin toss. My own personal view as a former director of campaigns and political operator is that it's a coin toss. It really is. And each side is going to spend a couple of billion dollars between now and the first Tuesday in November. The most important variable in U.S. politics is its structural polarization. And I think that social media, the tech companies, bear a huge amount of responsibility for that situation.
Right.
In an ideal world, they are non-ideological platforms that are governed by an agreed upon set of rules of propriety and commitment to facts that then allow people to speak freely on them about their views. Right.
Right.
But that's a dreamland, as you and I both know, and it's probably gotten worse since Musk bought Twitter a year and a half ago. So the alternative that we live in, not necessarily the best of all possible worlds, but the one we're in, is one where owners of these platforms are actively putting their thumb on the scale mm-hmm. of politics and pretty clearly directing their not insignificant algorithmic power to create tribes amongst citizens, right? I mean, the thing that nobody saw coming about the advent of social media is how it would create a heretofore unknown, certainly at this velocity, ability for people to find people who agreed with them, get together and find a group of people who disagreed with them, and then spend most of their life online throwing tomatoes at each other. Turns out, that's not good for democracy. Surprise, surprise. And the U.S. appears to be suffering from being the early adopter of this technology. Ever since social media, half of the United States has hated the other half of the United States. And more than that, they think each half thinks the other half is a bigger threat to the United States than anybody outside the United States. It kind of hasn't looked like that since the 1850s.
Well, listen, Jerry, really fascinating conversation. Thank you for being here on Politico Tech.
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm a huge fan.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Today's episode was produced by Afra Abdullah. I'm Stephen Overly. See you back here tomorrow.